but I passed the breath test. This is McDaniel Reynolds with the Reynolds Defense Firm, and we specialize in one thing. We represent good people facing DUI charges. While you know that it's illegal to drive with a .08 or greater blood alcohol content, not everyone knows that you could be arrested in Oregon for an alcohol DUI even if you blow well under a .08. This is a pretty loose standard, and it's a way that many of the good people we represent find themselves needing our help when they thought they were doing everything right. The Reynolds Defense Firm. We're solid, we're here if you need us, and we are very good at what we do.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
I'll tell you what, DJ Stephen Vaughn is only here to make me cooler. The music additions have been great. Thanks for that. You picking this stuff out yourself?
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to solicit suggestions from listeners, or are you good?
Yeah, feel free.
How do they get to you? Give us your socials, man.
Hit me up on Twitter, at Stephen_VON. I've already gotten a few. Some people have already reached out and got some. I've put them in the system. So, yeah, hit me up if you want to hear, got any requests.
He said hit me up. Even that's cool. Chris Hummer, our next guest, very cool as well. You can find his work both with CBS Sports and 24/7 Sports. A lot of sports in the Chris Hummer household. How you doing, man? You got multiple employers. I like that.
Same employer, all under the Paramount umbrella, but yeah, we're all trying to just get on Paramount Plus one of these days to be next to Jeff Frost and Survivor.
I love that. Hey, man, you're doing a hell of a job covering college football nationally, and you are covering a moving target in that I see your work on the transfer portal, I see your work on revenue sharing. It feels like this stuff is changing day to day. Is it fun for you to do that?
I mean, I don't know if any of us got into the business to cover court hearings and revenue sharing minutiae. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Like, there's never been a less boring time of being on the college athletics beat. So it certainly keeps you on your toes. And I used to think June was like the slowest time in the calendar, at least like 5 or 6 years ago. And it's anything but now.
We are days away now from July 1 with revenue sharing officially supposed to begin and people to be locked in. I saw your piece on Florida State's revenue sharing contracts. Why are they raising eyebrows? Why are people interested in what Florida State's doing with these contracts with players?
Well, I mean, I talked to more than a dozen people for the story just around the space, just trying to get a feel for what's normal and what isn't. I mean, I've seen a lot of revenue. I've seen a lot of NIL contracts, I should state that. But like, this is a new time where schools are putting together these rev share contracts and sending them to the athletes. And just like, I got a couple texts from people I know in the space, and they were like, Florida State's provisions are very aggressive, and they range from everything from like Florida State having full ability to essentially call an injury a breach of contract and essentially take away a player's money, to things like a player being able to the school being able to unilaterally essentially re-up a player's contract with no further negotiation if it's up at the same rate, to even like a provision where like Florida State can take away a player's right to counsel, like to an agency or a parent or whatever, after they sign their initial contract. And like, some provisions are usual in the contract, like not everything is outlandish or considered unusual, but those are provisions that drew a lot of eyebrows and are considered highly abnormal, talking to people in the space.
The idea that they could extend the deal is interesting to me, because I think one of the frustrations from fans is that it feels like unrestricted free agency every year, every offseason. So are you telling me that Florida State has found a way, with leverage being their friend, to potentially lock players into multiple years so they don't lose them?
Well, I should say a lot of these new contracts in the rev share era particularly will be multi-year. Like, that is a thing that is happening. Some players want that to happen. Some schools are pushing for it, and players are losing the leverage battle, but that is a normal occurrence in this era. And you'll see buyout language as well. Like, all of that is considered normal across the board. What's abnormal is, like, Florida State is trying to, if a player is out of time in his contract, let's say they signed a two-year deal at the end of year two, and that player emerges an All-American, Florida State is saying, like, the way it's written at least, Florida State can just re-up that player at the salary they were making before, which is considered highly unusual. And it's something I think a lot of people that are negotiating with Florida State have pushed against, because it's not language you would find in any contract that I'm aware of, at least on the rep share standpoint side.
From the player's standpoint, it would seem that at some point they'll need to collectively bargain, because they'll need some safeguards to prevent against stuff like this. I guess in that way, Florida State is kind of moving the ball along the track towards that. But do you see that being a thing that happens imminently? How far away is, you know, unionization of the players and or maybe collective bargaining?
Yeah, I guess it depends on how you define imminent. I anticipate it being something we see over the next, I think within half a decade, I think is the way we're moving at the speed at which we're moving. But I'd be remiss if I predicted like it's going to happen next year or something like that. I don't know specifically, but like college football is lost ground at every turn, right? Like you just keep retreating, keep retreating, keep retreating. And when I say college football, I mean the NCAA, the governors of these schools, president or chancellors, what have you, they keep losing ground. And I just think that's an area eventually they're going to lose ground on as well, because like you wouldn't be seeing things like this if things were collectively bargained. Like these things would be worked out ahead of time. There would be standardized agreements, which at this point, like really only the Big Ten has, the SEC and the ACC sort of have them. So yeah, I think we're heading that way eventually. It's just going to be a lot of things like this that pop up along the way.
Chris Hummer with us, CBS Sports, 24/7 Sports, and soon to be Paramount Plus. Chris, the going rate. We saw big deals. We saw a lot of the NIL collectives emptying the chamber, so to speak, just saying, "Hey, we better spend before revenue sharing and rules come in." And what do you think is going to happen to the market after July 1? You know, NIL and revenue sharing both. Do we get a settling of the market? Has it already started to settle? What are you seeing?
I think there's a hope it'll settle in college football, like front offices and coaching staffs and athletic directors' offices. There's a hope it would settle, but I think the hope is the key word there, because we don't really know how the NIL Go process is going to work. Like, deals are currently been submitted and approved. But, like, we haven't seen one of those big situations yet in which a player gets told no and then they go to court over it. And I think ultimately that's going to be the determination. There are going to be players and schools and agents who push this barrier as much as they can, and it's going to ultimately end up in the courts. And if, like, it's shown that, like, NIL Go and this, like, regulatory system is considered to be antitrust, then the floodgates open again and there's no restrictions. But if not, like, you're going to see contract values go down. Like, if you're thinking about, like, at least the natural flow of this, it's been a giant, like, bell curve, right? Like, this July, like, June 30th is the peak of that. Like, a lot of players are getting upfront massive payments from the deals they signed in December or January on June 30th as the last kind of dash of the collective money. And moving forward, like, on paper, like, schools are football schools mostly are going to be limited to like $14 to $16 million, and like maybe a school like Texas or Ohio State that has actual like brand value and actual like high leverage players can get another $2 or $3 million from like actual NIL. But you would think it would come down, but I think you're going to see some aggressive pushes to push back against that to prevent the market from becoming, depending on who you're talking to, artificially limited.
I was a little surprised in talking with some of the Pac-12, the New World Pac-12 athletic directors. They supported the revenue sharing model. And one of the arguments that they made was, hey, before there was a cap, we didn't know, like, you know, what Oregon or Ohio State or Texas could spend. Now we at least know what the ceiling is, and, you know, they can try to build rosters that in their own way can try to compete here and there, or they can play money ball. Do you get a sense of, you know, a Boise State or an Oregon State that wants to compete, or Memphis or Tulane that is hoping to punch above their weight? You know, they're not going to be able to spend $14 million with revenue sharing, but what do you think the floor is for a team that maybe is trying to squeak into the playoff? Like, do you need to spend 7, 10, 12? Like, what do you think we'll see?
I think that depends on how many AQs ultimately instituted under the new system. But, I mean, we saw Boise State get into the playoff this year. Like, I think you can win at $3 or $4 million. I don't think you're going to go very far. Like, I think there's sort of a ceiling cap on what a G5 school can do, but the hope is there. Like, you can get to that level. I just, I think it's difficult. I did a story earlier this offseason, and this was before the spring window, after the winter. I think 70% of returning first-team G5 players enter the transfer portal, like 70% of them. And, like, it's just really difficult for a G5 school to compete consistently when you have no roster stability, because as soon as you develop a really good player, he's more than likely going to go to the portal. Boise State's actually been the exception of that. They were one of the few schools that hung on to the large majority of their returning first-team and second-team players. But, like, for the most part, like, they were devastated across the board.
I am trying to figure out, you know, what I should be rooting for when it comes to all of this stuff, and your reporting has been fantastic on it. You're also closely following the transfer portal. In your mind, you know, the summertime, we're being told not to pay too much attention to it, but when is it sort of, when is it money time for you in watching the portal? Is it sort of that window at the end of the season? Is it the window that happens around the spring opening? And, you know, should there be two portal windows? Should there be one portal window? Where do you stand?
Personally, like, I would like to sleep more, so I'm all for one portal window. but
true.
I think one portal window makes the most sense. It's kind of a battle between, like, the amateur model of the sport still holding on and the professional model, because, like, on paper, it makes the most sense to do it in, like, late April, early May, but, like, that's impossible because kids need to, like, go enroll early and go to classes and get everything in. Like, you have to have some sort of optionality around January. And I guess, like, the best of the worst options in that scenario is putting it in early January after a lot of the bowl games and the early playoff games, and then having it open for a 10 or 15 day period. But I there's a lot of, like, there's a lot of desire from that, from coaching staffs and administrators, but there's also a pretty big hesitancy talking to people making those decisions, because, like, as soon as you restrict portal movement further, you risk getting sued. And the NCAA has had some wins recently, or, like, at least individual schools have had some cases, wins and the NCAA has had some wins and eligibility cases recently that they weren't having after the Diego Pavia ruling. But, like, eliminating a whole portal window, I think, is a different potential can of worms for schools to deal with.
We're talking to Chris Hummer, 24/7 Sports, CBS Sports. Chris, you mentioned sort of the wins for college athletics, and, you know, we have seen some of athletes seeking additional eligibility, additional years, get some pushback. Where do you think that ends up? Will community college count towards your eligibility, or will we one day say if you go to a community college, your clock doesn't start? You know, or is it just going to be everybody gets 5 years? What's the best way to resolve that, and what do you think happens?
I think the 5 for 5 is the most likely. I think that's what will eventually be instituted. But again, like, that's one of those things where, like, in an ideal, like, an idyllic world, they would have already done that. But, like, as soon as you do something like that, you're going to have, like, everybody who just graduated sticking out their hand saying, like, why not me? Mm. And I think that makes it difficult to institute. But, yeah, I do think 5 for 5 is logical. I think if you look at the average time it takes somebody to graduate in college, it's like 4.5 years. Like, it makes a lot of sense to do 5 for 5, but it's just, like, difficult to start that system over again. Because at the end of the day, like, as soon as you do 5 for 5, you're also screwing an entire class of recruits. So it's difficult to implement on the fly, but I do think eventually that's where we end up.
Most impactful transfer nationally. Do you have one or two that you really like and are intrigued to see this season?
Maybe it's just because I was just at the Manning Academy and he was here, but I think John Mateer is, like, a guy at Oklahoma coming from Washington yep. State who has the potential to swing the direction of the season, specifically because, like, there's so much pressure on Brent Venables right now, and they have a roster that's positioned well enough to be competitive in the SEC, so he's somebody I think of, and, I mean, that answer is almost always going to be a quarterback. It's just kind of how it goes, but he's the first guy top of mind that I think of in that regard.
He's so good, and I know Washington State was sad to see him go, but how do you turn away life-changing money if you're John Mateer? And I think a lot of people at Washington State understood that. Chris, I really appreciate your time. I know you're traveling. Thank you for joining us, and keep up the good work, and get yourself on Paramount Plus.
One day. I appreciate it, man.
Goals, man, goals. CBS Sports, 24/7 Sports, Chris Hummer. Follow him on social media. Good stuff there as it pertains to the business of college athletics. The 4 o'clock hour will feature the BFT jury, including John Strong, the voice of American soccer, Michael Llewellyn, former Blazers executive. We're going to put the Blazers on trial. We're also going to put the Pac-12 and Texas State on trial. We got a lot to talk about, and our big splash is next.